people shell out, as you said, thousands of dollars basically for the opportunity to suffer.
Results are in for this year's Mount Marathon race in Seward. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 4th. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, bald eagles in Unalaska illustrate the might of our national bird.
They will do whatever they think is necessary to protect their young, and that typically includes launching themselves at people and using their talons to blast right their heads.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson confirmed today that North Korea's latest missile test was with an intercontinental ballistic missile. Though the U.S. military's initial assessment was that the North Koreans fired an intermediate-range missile, Tillerson's statement offered the first confirmation from the administration that it was, in fact, an ICBM. The latest missile flew higher and longer than any previous one, sparking concerns it could hit major population centers in Alaska, like Anchorage or Fairbanks. Tillerson says this represents a new escalation of the threat posed to the United States and the world by North Korea and plans on bringing the action before the United Nations Security Council. Russia and China have proposed that North Korea declare a moratorium on nuclear and missile tests, while the U.S. and South Korea refrain from large-scale military exercises. The 2017 Mount Marathon race in Seward is over, and a familiar champion has taken first in the women's race. I spoke with Alaska Dispatch News sports reporter Doyle Woody about this year's event and its history.
The women's race was won by Allie Ostrander of Soldotna. She's 20 and a legend already in Alaska running. She won the junior title six times. 2 years ago, she did the adult race for the first time and not only finished second to a world-class runner from Sweden named Emily Forsberg, but like Forsberg, broke a record that had stood for 25 years by Nancy Peace way back in the day. In the men's race, Scott Patterson basically conducted a one-man time trial and obliterated the field pretty much from the gun and built up a big enough lead he could take it easy on the downhill because he had a few problems with his ankle on the downhill last year.
To somebody who's never been to Seward, never seen Mount Marathon, maybe doesn't know much about mountain running, how hard of a race is this, and what are the conditions like?
Today, the conditions were pretty good. I'm told the mountain was a little slow. The terrain kind of changes now and then, just kind of based on weather. But it's a mountain that's roughly 3,000 feet. You're all but going from sea level to 3,000 feet, and it has an average pitch of 34 degrees. So only the most elite people can do any amount of running, and it's a small amount, on the uphill. It basically is a power hike the whole way up, and having done it 1,000 years ago when I was a young man, your thighs just burn the entire way, your lungs just burn, you drip sweat. It's alternately awful and wonderful at the same time, and the downhill's just crazy. You stand here, you look at the top of Mount Marathon, you think 10 and a half minutes, the dude who just rounded the top of that peak is going to be standing here. And it's just so hard to wrap your head around year after year, but they do it. And it really is an amazing thing. And what a great thing about this race is you have often very elite athletes, and yet you have, you know, Jim and Susie from down the street who are pretty fit people who are doing it as well. So it really is a special race.
Do you know why it has such a cult following among athletes and amateurs and everyone? I mean, the day before the race, the last few open spots are auctioned off, and these spots go for thousands of dollars. I mean, why is it such a big deal for people?
Back then in the 80s and even into the very early 90s, you could virtually sign up a week, 2 weeks, a month before the race and have no problem getting in. But as mountain running became more popular, it's a limited field in each division because the mountain can only handle so much traffic. And it became really hard to get into. And it got to the point where this lottery is just nuts. I mean, people shell out, as you said, thousands of dollars basically for the opportunity to suffer.
That was Doyle Woody, sports reporter and columnist for the Alaska Dispatch News, talking about the Mount Marathon race in Seward. The U.S. Coast Guard responded to reports of four fishing vessels taking on water from Sunday night to Monday morning in Bristol Bay's Nooshigak District. No one was reported injured, and crew members were rescued by Good Samaritan vessels. One, the fishing vessel N-11, capsized and sank after deck loading a big catch of sockeye. According to the U.S. Coast Guard, the Good Samaritan vessel run out, recovered all four crew members. After 2 a.m. Monday, the FV Bunchy began taking on water just below Akuk. The Good Samaritan vessel Ann Louise took the Bunchy's four crew members aboard and towed the boat back to the beach. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game reports at least two other vessels were also beached, likely to prevent boats from sinking under the weight of too many fish. State staff flew an aerial survey Monday to assess for possible spilled fuels, but reported nothing major was seen. The owners of the vessels were taking steps to appropriately pump off fuel and oil and dispose of wasted salmon, according to Fish and Game. A week ago, the Nooshigak District set a record for a single-day harvest, landing more than a million sockeye. The run dropped off for several days before getting over the million mark again yesterday, only the second time in recorded history. Two processors had to stop buying fish for part of the day Monday. So far, fishermen have caught 5.2 million sockeye. Southeast Alaska tribal groups are calling for cleanup of British Columbia's long-abandoned Tulsequa Chief Mine. The call comes as a Canadian investment firm shops the prospect to potential new owners. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Tulsequa Chief is an underground copper, gold, zinc, lead, and silver mine about 40 miles northeast of Juneau. Acidic wastewater has been draining into the Tulsequa River since the mine shut down 60 years ago. That's a tributary of a waterway that flows through Alaska into the Pacific.
The Tulsequa Chief Mine has been polluting the Taku River watershed since the 1950s.
Frederick Olson Jr. is chairman of the United Tribal Transboundary Mining Work Group, which includes 16 tribal governments in southeast Alaska. He's also president of the Organized Village of Kasan, that Prince of Wales Island City's tribal government. Those groups, plus Juneau's Douglas Indian Association, are calling for the U.S. and Canadian governments to clean up the mine site and end the pollution.
This is an international issue. It needs international solutions. BC cannot be relied upon to clean this up.
British Columbia has promised to do just that. Minister of Mines Bill Bennett visited the Tulsequa Chief in 2015 as part of a Southeast Alaska tour. He was visibly upset by what he saw and promised action. Late last year, he reiterated his commitment to clean it up, though he also cited studies claiming the mine discharge did not harm fish.
It's still against our rules for that water to be flowing into the Tulsequa River. So one way or the other, we have to stop it.
But Bennett is no longer Minister of Mines. He retired this spring. His replacement, Rich Coleman, was not immediately available for comment, and he may not be at all. That's because his boss, BC Premier Christy Clark, just resigned after losing a vote of confidence in the province's Legislative Assembly. Her replacement is from a competing party. Chris Zimmer is an activist with the group Rivers Without Borders.
Despite the promises from BC that they were going to clean up the mine, it looks like their real hope was to get a new buyer, shift the cleanup responsibility to them, and hope that they would then develop the mine.
Mine owner Chieftain Metals filed for bankruptcy last fall. That left the Tulsequa Chief in the hands of an investment company. Court documents filed in early June show the company has attracted more than a dozen potential buyers and identified one as most likely to take action. But Chieftain and another company have already gone out of business trying to reopen the Tulsequa Chief. Zimmer says a new buyer will have the same problem.
That's a recipe for more bankruptcies, more pollution, and heavy industrialized mining right above some of the best salmon habitat in the Taku.
Mine critics have called for involvement in a U.S.-Canada commission that resolves Boundary Waters disputes, but so far that hasn't happened. Olson of the Transboundary Work Group says tribal officials are worried about damage to subsistence fishing.
We need the federal government of the United States to to uphold its fiduciary trust responsibility to its tribal citizens and its federally recognized tribes, and to its citizens of the state of Alaska. It needs to protect us and our way of life from these massive projects.
Two new British Columbia mines opened recently in transboundary watersheds. Several more projects are under exploration. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what to do when wildlife wander into a military exercise.
It's not always buffalo. Sometimes it's moose. Sometimes it's nesting waterfowl.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Educators from across the nation are currently gathering in Boston, Massachusetts for the annual meeting of the National Education Association, the largest teachers union in the country. Alaska NEA President Tim Parker is attending, along with 64 other state members, to learn about education initiatives around the country and to discuss how to improve schools in Alaska. Parker says that his biggest concern is the uncertain future of the state's education budget.
We're going to be in exactly the same spot next year. We've already seen 5 years of increased class sizes and program cuts to schools all across the state. And this year, even though they didn't cut it as much as the Senate had proposed at one point, we're seeing diminished funding and we're seeing teacher layoffs and program cuts continue.
Among the topics discussed at the meeting was this year's rollout of the Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESA. ESA replaces the No Child Left Behind Act and gives states more power over setting standards for their schools and over evaluating teachers. Parker says he has been speaking with educators from other states about how to improve methods for evaluating student progress.
And some of them are super creative. New Hampshire is piloting some things where instead of doing that cheap standardized test, the students come in and they, there was one class I was reading about where they actually have to investigate an oil spill.
The NEA annual meeting ends tomorrow. Military pilots cannot harass wildlife during training exercises. That was the reminder issued by Eielson Air Force Base officials last month after a pilot asked for permission to fly low over several bison to scare them away from the Donnelly training area near Fort Greely. Aircraft were preparing for live fire training exercises there at the time. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Officials with Eielson's 354th Fighter Wing say Air Force personnel participating in a red flag training exercise last month followed regulations that require activity to be halted when wildlife is present on a training range.
You cease fire, you call it into range control, and range control then tells you wait until they leave.
John Pinnell is a spokesman for U.S. Army Alaska, which manages the Donnelly training area, and he says that's basically what happened on June 13th after an Air Force pilot requested permission to fly low over a group of bison that had wandered into a part of the range where several A-10s were about to begin a live fire training exercise.
That might be your first impulse, if you see something out there in an area where you want to be, is to see if you can't chase it away. But we're not permitted to do that.
Eielson officials declined to talk about the incident and instead issued a news release that says Air Force personnel overseeing the exercise and Army range controllers denied the pilot's request to buzz the bison.
It did not happen because the pilot was told that it is not allowed.
Bob Schmidt is a wildlife biologist with the State Fish and Game Office in Delta Junction, located a few miles from the big training ranges around Greeley. Schmidt says he talked with a range control official late in the morning on the 13th who'd called to double-check about state laws that, like the federal regulations, prohibit harassing wildlife.
That's a common thing where wildlife is present and they can't fire.
Pinnell, the USARAC spokesman, agrees.
It's not an uncommon occurrence. It's not always buffalo. Sometimes it's moose.
Sometimes it's nesting waterfowl in a wetlands area.
Eielson officials said in their news release that all personnel involved in that day's training exercise were reminded of regulations governing encounters with wildlife on training ranges. The release says officials determined no disciplinary action was warranted. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Today is the 4th of July, a day for celebrating national pride and national symbols like the bald eagle. But in Unalaska, people are more likely to try to protect themselves from the majestic bird than to throw a party for it. Unalaska is the national hotspot for bald eagle attacks. Biologists and city officials say you're more likely to face the wrath of a raptor here than anywhere else in the country. This nesting season, KUCB's Barrett Wilbur found out why.
In Unalaska, you are most likely to be attacked by a bald eagle in the post office parking lot. Wildlife trooper Damian Lopez Plankart just escorted the first eagle attack victim of the season to the medical clinic. He points out the eagle sitting on its nest, staring at us.
There were no eyewitnesses. When she looked up, that eagle was just sitting there.
I didn't do it. No, I didn't do it.
Nesting season for America's national bird runs from early June to the end of summer. Deputy Police Chief Jennifer Shockley is on the front line of the island's eagle response team.
We have these signs that we put up every year to remind people that there are nesting eagles in the area, that they will do whatever they think is necessary to protect their young, and that typically includes launching themselves at people and using their talons to lacerate their heads.
With 7-foot wingspans, flesh-ripping beaks, and vice-like talons, eagles rule the island. But why are there annual eagle attacks in Unalaska when raptors and humans peacefully coexist everywhere else in the state? It's because of the interaction between two eagle needs, food and space. According to Lopez Plankart,
there's a lot of food to support a lot of eagles, but there's not enough space in that small area where the food is to support that many number of nesting pairs.
Fish are the staple of the bald eagle's diet, and Unalaska processes more fish than any other port in the country. Boats, processors, and garbage create a year-round smorgasbord which eagles want to nest as close to as possible. But eagles usually nest in trees. Unalaska has no trees. Instead, eagles raise chicks on the tundra and on cliff outcroppings. Their nests are a lot more accessible to people, Shockley says, which makes the eagles a lot more territorial.
We actually have had to go and chase some eagles off of some of the playground equipment at Town Park because a couple of kids had been trapped inside.
Shockley estimates 6 to 10 people a year seek medical attention for eagle encounters, usually head gashes from talons, which lead to stitches and expensive medical bills. But most Unalaskans remain pretty good-natured about the raptors next door. U.S. Coast Guard Lieutenant Andres Ayare is a good example. On his third day in Unalaska, he was chased down the side of a mountain by a bald eagle.
I thought for sure this eagle wanted to kill me. I'm thinking, one, oh heck no, I'm not gonna die in Dutch Harbor. Two, oh crap, I better start running.
The bird swooped at him repeatedly, ripped his hood off his head, and forced him to the ground. It even stole the cell phone, which fell out of his pocket. And yet,
as I was getting attacked, I was still admiring the eagle for being so majestic. It was a fantastic looking eagle.
Now, Ari keeps an eagle figurine on his desk. When he's restationed, it's a piece of Unalaska he'll hold on to, knowing that somewhere out there, an eagle with his cell phone is holding on to a piece of him, too. In Unalaska, I'm Barrett Wilbur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Commercial fishing is a key industry in Southeast Alaska, but managing the fisheries sometimes means donning scuba gear to check out the ocean floor. KFSK's Angela Denning caught up with some state divers while they took a break from their normal schedule.
This thing is big.
Yeah, it is.
A lot of hermit crabs, too.
Children and adults alike are huddling around small totes on the dock at Petersburg's North Harbor. The plastic containers are full of creatures crawling around in seawater. They were brought to the surface by divers with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Watch this guy.
Yep.
He's moving.
There's a variety of animals, sea stars, urchins, scallops, a tiny octopus, all kinds of crabs, and something else rather peculiar. It looks like a large whitish sea plant with pod-shaped branches.
These are squid eggs, actually, and I've never seen these before. But
they're Jeff squid?
Yeah, these are egg sacs from squid.
That's biologist Joe Stratman, wearing a red and black dry suit. He manages crab fisheries in southeast Alaska, but once a year gets a chance to do some diving, too.
Yeah, it almost looks like an anemone, but it's just a bunch of collections of squid eggs and these. And I think there's a single one here, but they're just all sort of stuck together and the eggs are inside.
Also showing off the sea life today is dive safety officer Jeff Mucci.
This one here is related to these guys here, but these guys live in the harbors and this one lives out at the ocean.
Mucci is the one who found the squid eggs. He's been diving for the state for 17 years.
I've never seen it before, where there were thousands and thousands of squid, male and females, coming together, mating, and laying all these eggs. The whole seafloor was just covered with these skeins of squid eggs. It was just really cool.
Mucci's enthusiasm for sea science and his job are contagious.
They're kind of expressive, like they're dancing or something.
Mm-hmm.
I have lots and lots of pictures. Like, look at this one here. You know, it looks like he's almost running across the bottom.
Yeah.
These are his arms. They're really cool.
Mucci supervises state diving in Southeast from British Columbia to Yakutat. He works out of the state research vessel, Kestrel. He dives mostly near Ketchikan, Sitka, and Craig, doing stock assessments for geoducks, sea cucumbers, and red urchins. That information determines what can be harvested in the fall fisheries. In the spring, he's checking on herring. But more recently, the state divers have started working with the Science Center in Sitka to research how many abalone sea snails are in Southeast. The species was harvested back in the 80s and 90s, and researchers want a baseline population. The divers are also collaborating with the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center to study some new invasive species. One is the green crab south of Ketchikan, and another is something known as tunicates, found near Sitka.
It's like a sponge. It covers everything. It's not natural to Southeast Alaska, but they were brought in somehow into Whiting Harbor, and they have started to cover all the rock and the kelp. And I think what people are concerned about is that we don't want that invasive species to impact any of the habitat that the herring might be spawning on.
Mucci and other divers are helping to find ways to safely eradicate the tunicates in the harbor. But aside from researching specific species, one of Mucci's favorite things to do is share sea creature science with the public.
I mean, these are things that are all around us, and you know, I've been doing this for 17 years, and I'm still excited to get back in the water every morning. I can hardly wait to get in the water. I get wore out by the end of a trip, but I'm very fortunate. I love what I do.
Probably
you see
not.
The abalone in there? The abalone shells?
You don't belong here.
Mucci knows most people don't have access to the sea like he does, and he enjoys helping them get at least a peek at that underwater world. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
In the controlled chaos of Bristol Bay's commercial and subsistence fishing, it can be easy to lose track of the third group the salmon get to, sport fishermen. They come from all over to fish with guides at camps and lodges along southwest Alaska rivers. Those guides are just part of the infrastructure that keeps sport fishing going. KDLG's Allison Mollenkamp spent the day at one Nushagak spot, Toman's King Camp, to look behind the scenes.
The best stretch of river for sports fishermen is a boat or plane ride away from Dillingham. Andy Hawkinson runs the administrative side of Toman's. She says the float planes present some challenges.
Their bigger plane, the Beaver, is I think 1,500 pounds. But that goes fast. If you have four large guys mm-hmm. and then they have bags and they also have a 50-pound fish box each.
Yeah. Some clients aren't too eager about the planes either. Andy recalls one regular customer.
He's terrified. Yeah, he doesn't like those little planes. He flew in last year, and there was a windstorm. It was pretty bad. But it was still okay to fly, but it was rough. So he said, absolutely not, I'm not getting on that plane.
So he had to get a room in Dillingham to spend the night, and we picked him up the next morning and boated him over.
The boats bring more than people up to camp. All the camp supplies are brought up from Dillingham by boat before the season starts. The shopping, however, started long before that.
Jeremy and I will shop in Oregon, and we'll put everything up on a barge, all of our dry goods.
All that food lets the camp kitchen feed up to 50 or 60 people per night. Behind that effort is Pam McClung, who runs a small catering business in Portland. Cooking at a camp up the Nooshigak is a little different.
Pretty much the last of our fresh produce.
With one of their busiest weeks, the short season ending this weekend, they don't plan to order more.
We're really right now on an as-needed basis. It just gets very expensive. So now we're playing chop kitchen, which is fine. We're having fun. So we'll plan our menu a couple days in advance, depending on what we have, and then we pull stuff out of the freezer accordingly.
For all the challenges, the menu is pretty impressive.
We're having actually fish, brisket, and pork quesadillas, and lasagna from dinner last night.
The quesadillas are the work of the kitchen's second driving force, Manuel Rodriguez. He's been cooking at Toman's for 12 summers, and it doesn't take long to think of his favorite part.
Oh, the cold.
You like the cold?
It's too hot in my city. 114 every day.
He met the camp's owner, Jeremy Toman, in Mexico. One of his many ventures is a mule deer hunting operation there.
The Mexico hunt is, I've done that for 20 years now, too. It's probably one of my favorite things to do. The weather's always nice.
The weather on the Nooshigak is a little more variable. Clients will fish in pretty much all weather, but some rare sunshine peeking through the morning they're supposed to leave makes the parting a little harder.
I want to go fishing. I know, but I'm trying to get 22 people out of here in one day.
It will take a handful of flights to move 22 people back down to Dillingham. Most of their luggage and boxes of fish will go back by boat, which can prove to be a wet, windy, bumpy ride. A few hours later, a new crop of clients will be on their way in. Running a king camp on the Nooshigak can be hard work, but for Jeremy Toman, it's definitely worth it.
There's nothing better than having a group full of clients in your dining tent laughing and giggling because it's such a great place to be.
The fish and laughter keep the clients coming back, too. A lot of Toman's clients book their trip for next year before they leave. One of Toman's clients, Cho, is a little young to book another trip himself.
It was very slow that day. We had only caught one jack, and I was starting to fall asleep. And then my fish pole starts rattling and rattling really fast. And then my dad looks at my pole, and he says, "It's shaking! What are you doing, Cho?" And then I'm like, what? And then he grabs my rod, and then I start reeling, and then it was about a 15-minute fight. Boy, that thing was a monster.
Did you end up weighing it? How much was it?
40 pounds.
So far, 10-year-old Cho holds the record for the summer at Toman's. I'm Allison Mollenkamp.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. Avery Lill and Allison Mollenkamp reported from Dillingham, Barrett Wilbur in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Henry Leisha in Anchorage, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Ann Hillman produced tonight's broadcast. And I am Zachariah Hughes. Happy 4th of July.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
A Veterans Town Hall featuring Dr. Timothy Ballard will take place on July 6th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the National Guard Armory in Fairbanks. The event is open to all. The VA welcomes frank and open discussions of veterans' concerns in all program areas. Time will be made available for individuals to address their concerns in one-on-one sessions. For more information, email samuel.hudson@va.gov. This message sponsored by the VA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.